May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is John Case. My AR number is 15443. I need an appellant here. I did not submit supplemental authority and I did not request oral argument. I know you're familiar with the briefs. I just want to reiterate the four issues that I raised, why I think Ms. Goss did not get a fair trial, and I will be happy to address questions that you have.
All right, we'll start.
Okay.
There were apparently 15 statements.
Correct.
There was no dispute that there was publication of those statements, correct?
Correct.
And you're attacking one of them.
I'm attacking one in particular. I think of the 15, there's others that are questionable as to whether they're opinion or fact, but I think one in particular, the man in Mozart, the man in black comparison, I think is a statement of opinion that is not defamatory per se. Jury instruction number 8 instructed the jurors that the statements which were contained in 9 in one instruction, all 15 statements, were defamatory per se. The jurors, one of their first questions, jury question number 2, was, is the court saying that these are defamatory per se? The answer returned was yes.
So, in the situation where you've got 14 others, that at least the way I read your briefs, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're not attacking those on appeal. You're simply saying the man in black statement was not defamatory per se.
Correct.
Assuming that to be true, why is this reversible?
I think it's reversible because the jury could have relied on the statement of opinion in the bulk listing of the statements as the basis for their verdict for defamation. And the case that I cited that I think was closest on that was Clark v. Giacomo, I believe, in which was a securities case in which there were two statements, one about others that purchased their stock and one about proceeds from dividends could pay the note, and the court ruled that the inclusion of the one statement that couldn't have legally been the basis was a statement that the jury might have relied on coming to its verdict. I think the same reasoning should apply here, that if you include statements of opinion with say, let's assume statements that are defamatory per se, and you instruct that all are, how do you know what the jury relied on in arriving at their verdict?
Was there any closing argument devoted to the man in black discussion? Did the counsel in the trial specifically focus upon that statement? That's my question.
From my reading of the transcript, no. In closing argument, it was not focused on by trial counsel.
Was there an objection to including that statement in the listing of defamatory statements?
Yes, I believe there was, and there was a I don't have the reference.
Well, the next question I was going to ask is, then did the counsel for our replacement, actually, the counsel for that insist that that remain in there? I mean, there were 14 other statements that could have provided a basis for a defamation claim. Was there argument by the plaintiff's lawyer that that man in black statement should remain in the instructions? What were the objection?
I believe there were competing jury instructions submitted, mm-hmm. and the plaintiff's, I don't recall from the transcript that plaintiff's counsel specifically referenced that statement as being necessary and to be included within the statements, but the jury instructions submitted was all the statements from an internet publication were submitted together.
Okay. You refer to it as not being defamatory per se. You also refer to it as being an opinion. I don't think those two are necessarily synonymous. A statement that, as I understand the law, a statement that's defamatory per se simply does not require any special damages.
Well,
is that how they were used here, or was it used here just as a user opinion?
I think there's two elements to that. A statement that is defamatory per se is defamatory on its face and is immediately recognizable as such without explanation or context. If I say he's a thief, that's defamatory per se, and then I'm accusing him of having committed a theft. If I say he's comparable to the man in black and Mozart, I think that requires an explanation and some context for you to know what I'm talking about.
Okay. So it's your, as I understand the position you're brief, to decide this, we have to look at a case like the KCNC subsidiary case, that says that we have to determine as a matter of law whether the statement contains or implies a verifiable fact, and whether the statement reasonably susceptible to being understood as an assertion of actual fact. Is that the two-part test that you're urging us to apply to this statement, Mann and Block?
I'm urging you, well, there's two parts to that test as to the distinction between libel per se, libel per plot. One, is it capable of being proven true or false? That is it an opinion? If it's not capable of being true or false, it's an opinion. There is a second requirement, libel per quat, and there is a distinction between, I think, two divisions of the court as to the special damages. Does it have to then specifically reference the person defamed, which was the Lynn case that I cited and the Gordon v. Boyles case that the appellees cited. So, yeah, I agree there are multiple parts to it.
I don't know if you intend to argue it, but do you stand on your position that this should be reversed because the witness was not allowed, the lawyer witness was not allowed to testify?
Yes, I think that was a disproportionate sanction for the reasons I argued. That witness was Mr. Biss's, the artist's attorney. He was disclosed by both parties in their initial Rule 16 disclosures in fairly summary fashion, as a person with knowledge. There was no discovery undertaken with respect to him. Trial counsel for Ms. Goss submitted then a witness and exhibit list 2 weeks late. It's supposed to be 42 days before the trial got in, close to a month before. But the witness and exhibit list for a trial management order does not have any recitation of what the witness is going to testify to. It's only the identification of the witness and the length of the potential examination. So when that late filing came in the 2 weeks before the late filing of the witness list was filed, counsel for the appellee filed a motion in limine to bar undisclosed witnesses and exhibits, including then Mr. Burnett, the attorney. The judge deferred ruling on that prior to trial because he said he wanted to know more. He ended up not ruling until the fourth and final day of the trial. Mm-hmm. And then he totally precluded Mr. Burnett's testimony. Now, by that time, as you see in the references to the transcript, they discussed what it was Mr. Burnett might testify to. And Mr. Burnett's testimony had been mentioned by Mr. Zuger in the trial, not his testimony, but his existence and his role on several occasions in the testimony. So why I see that as harmless is because the motion to bar Mr. Burnett would have not come up but for the late filing of the witness list. But even a timely filing of the witness list would have been after the close of discovery. So there would have been no opportunity for the appellees then to undertake discovery with Mr. Burnett. They had that opportunity throughout the long pretrial history, but nobody did any discovery with respect to Mr. Burnett.
The Todd case lists a number of factors that we're supposed to consider in deciding and reviewing whether a sanction, discovery sanction, is appropriate or not.
Yes.
The very first factor is the importance of the witness's testimony. But as I read your brief, I have no idea what it was that Mr. Burnett was going to testify to, nor can I ascertain the importance of his testimony. So I'm not sure how we can decide that, even the first factor, what they were your client.
I agree. I did not see much in the transcript about what Mr. Burnett's testimony would be until the argument over precluding him. There was an offer regarding he's going to testify to some agreements. There is a reference in the trial transcript, June 26, page 21, and another, where Mr. Zuger talks about Mr. Burnett having signed an agreement on behalf of Mr. Biss and negotiating on behalf of Mr. Biss. So I think you're correct. I didn't see an offer of proof from trial counsel as to specifically what Mr. Burnett's testimony would be. And I agree that trial counsel's offer that there would be a partial waiver of the attorney-client privilege, I think, was inappropriate. I don't think you can do the sword and shield thing and partially waive it at that point. So
we just heard about that. No, the prior case.
So I'm somewhat in the dark as to what Mr. Burnett's testimony might have been.
So how are we supposed to decide the first top factor, the importance of his testimony to your client's case? I don't know how we're supposed to decide that. We have no showing of what it is.
even what it is, much less the importance of it. And that's the first factor that we have to take into account.
The only thing I could find that I can point to is the trial transcript from June 26th.
Mr. Zuger's testimony.
Which was Mr. Zuger's testimony, who testified that Mr. Burnett had signed agreements on behalf of Mr. Biss on page 21 of that day, on line 10, that Mr. Burnett had negotiated agreements on behalf of Mr. Biss, and also on page 21 from that day, line 17. Zuber's counsel asked him what Mr. Burnett had told you about some particular. So I'm assuming that at a minimum, Mr. Burnett could have responded to that testimony about those items. But that's the only reference in the transcript that I could find.
It's hard to extrapolate from that how that relates to interference with respect to, I assume, the interference claim, not the libel claim, but the defamation claim.
The interference claim.
I assume that his testimony would have been related to the interference claim, not the defamation claim, but I can't tell from that description what he would have said that would have had any bearing on the defense.
I can only agree with you that is the only reference I find in the transcript. But
right.
I would point out that, you know, Mr. Burnett would have been the only other witness for the defense. Ms. Goss was a difficult witness. She did lack legal or business sophistication. She appeared, I believe, incredible to the trial judge and the jury. So my assumption would be that Mr. Burnett, as the attorney for Mr. Biss, might have been able to shed some light on the professionalism or lack of professionalism in agreements between Biss and Zuber. But I can see there was not an offer of proof by trial counsel as to what that was. Other questions?
It appears not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Glenn Merrick, registration 10042, on behalf of the Appellees Cross Appellants. There is a cross appeal here. There are four issues that are raised by the appellants in principle. Those four are that Mr. Burnett's testimony should not have been excluded. In fact, there was a pattern of failure to disclose in the trial court by Ms. Goss. She was the subject of two motions to compel for failing to make 26A1 disclosures and for failure to respond to discovery. Both motions to compel were granted. The first one was ignored by Ms. Goss even after being granted. She was sanctioned with monetary sanctions at least twice in the trial court for failing to disclose both witnesses, persons who might have knowledge, as well as providing discovery responses. There was a pattern of non-disclosure, and there's an allegation here that despite the fact that there was a third non-disclosure, the disclosure to disclose consistent with Rule 16 F2B, that perhaps the sanction was excessive.
Was Mr. Burnett disclosed? Despite all the non-disclosures, was Mr. Burnett disclosed? Because I think counsel said he had been.
His name was disclosed.
Yes.
Ultimately his name was disclosed. After motions to compel had been filed, but he was not disclosed as a trial witness consistent with 16 F2B. Secondly, there was no suggestion as to what other appropriate sanction might remedy the issue. Finally, there was no offer of proof as to what Mr. Burnett would testify to ever in the trial court or on appeal. It is simply a blank page. So it would seem to me to be entirely inappropriate to reward Ms. Goss after behavior such as that in the trial court to say, gee, we're not going to hold you responsible for a witness that you didn't disclose. And by the way, at trial, what they wanted to do is to put Mr. Burnett on the stand to testify about certain conversations and conduct that he had with respect to Mr. Biss, but to prevent further inquiry into what else might be related to that conduct and communication, which was the subject of the trial testimony, a selective waiver of the attorney-client privilege, which of course has never been permitted. Now, the question was raised about...
Mr. Merrick, may I interrupt for a moment? Given that Mr. Biss was deceased, does the attorney-client privilege continue after death?
Well, I would think so. I don't know of any case law that you caught me flat-footed I don't know of any case law that says the attorney-client privilege ceases at death. My surmise would be that it would pass to the estate of the deceased person, since that's the legal representative of the deceased person, whether it be intestacy or whether it be a probate matter. The question was raised with respect to the statement that the plaintiffs are comparable to the man in black for Mozart as being not defamatory and a statement of opinion. As the court has already stated, and correctly so, this is not a statement of opinion because it implies facts that are the basis of the opinion. Indeed, if you read the publication from which the statements were taken, which was the www.earlbiss.com website, the professed official website of Earl Biss and his estate, you will see that it is part of a pattern, an integrated pattern of remarks and representations about the plaintiffs in the trial court below. And those representations immediately following that statement set forth a series of allegations and representations of fact which relate directly to the statement that the plaintiffs are comparable to the man in black for Mozart, which parallel precisely the opera Mozart and Salieri by Alexander Pushkin. Now, you know what's really...
Does one have to be educated to understand that reference? I mean, it seems to me that saying it's comparable to Man in Black for Mozart, it's difficult for me, acting as a lawyer, to understand what that means, let alone a layperson understand that that's defamatory.
That's an interesting observation, and one that I think that probably is not that well developed in the law. But the point is, who was the audience? The audience was those who would go to that website, who were specifically looking to artwork, fine artwork, and are an educated audience. That's an audience that has interest in culture, in arts, and in those sorts of matters. That's an audience that understands exactly what that representation is. That's an audience that has familiarity with opera, with fine art. That's a reference that those people understand and was uniquely designed to injure the plaintiffs. If you said it on the streets of city and county of Denver, that might be one thing. You might have a relatively modest population which understands the reference. This population to which that representation was targeted is not that population. It's a population that spends thousands and thousands of dollars in discretionary income for fine artwork. So this is... and by the way, it's not really all that unusual. It was made into a very famous movie. You may have heard of it, Amadeus.
Do you agree? Well, you say in your brief at page 20 that to determine whether the statement is one of opinion or of fact, you then quote the language from the KCNC case, the NBC subsidiary, 879-56. Usually that's the standard that we're supposed to apply to determine whether this is a defamatory statement. What is the verifiable fact contained in the statement? The company is like the man, comparable to the man in black. What's the verifiable fact in the statement?
In Mozart and Salieri, Salieri is a dark person who is attributed with driving Mozart to his death by working him to death for pittance and wages, and someone who was responsible for destroying the man. If you read the statements right following on the website, what was allegedly done by Mr. Zuger and American Design Limited is that they drove Mr. Biss into his grave by working him to death for a pittance.
So that statement has to be read in context with all the other statements to make it defamatory. That's your position.
My point is that if you look at the context of the statement, it is, one, defamatory per se, because the publication itself is one that demonstrates that it is harmful and is libelous per se. Moreover, if you look at it in context, and if you look at it in context of the other statements, it's libelous per quad, and there was damages proved at trial.
Now, how was the jury instructed, though? Weren't they instructed, and they could understand that if any one of those statements was published, they could find defamation?
The jury was...
They didn't have to find that all 14 were published, did they?
The jury was instructed that the court had to determine that the statements were libels. And that was, in fact, a question which came from the jury room, which was responded to by Judge Stern, the trial judge. So the jury was instructed that, in fact, the statements were libels. And the trial court found all 15 of the statements. But to Judge Casebolt's point earlier, in connection with his questioning of appellant's counsel, there's no challenge whatsoever on appeal to any of the other 14 statements. And you can read the 14 statements that are pages 3 through 5 of our brief. Mm-hmm. And those statements demonstrate a pattern of invidious, malicious effort to try and destroy Mr. Doss's business. Now, this is a pattern that has to be read collectively. But any of those statements made to an official website to the audience that to which they were directed would have this kind of effect. What the argument that's being made...
Let me just stop for a second, if I might. I'm sorry, Mr. Moran. You have these set out on here as bullet points. And I take it that these were 14 independent statements. They weren't... This isn't one document where this is sentence after sentence after sentence, is it? It's different statements... Or is it? It is one document with 14 sentences in a row like this? Or is it multiple? I know that it's not a document, it's an email or something, but are they all in one package together, or are they different statements at different times?
No.
They sound like bullet points, I know there were 14 separate things.
And the reason they're done that way was because of the trial, I put them on a board.
Okay.
Okay. So, well, no, they're in a single document, which they define. It's a web page. So what you have to do is go to the web page. And so when you read the web page, what I did was I went through the web page
okay.
and identified, you know, one statement after another. Some do follow one right after another. Sometimes there's other text in between, like Ms. Goss makes the representation that she's the personal representative of the state. Now the state says that these guys are crooks, bad guys, and thieves. Okay, well, there is language in between, so I don't want you to believe that they're consecutively contained, but they are in the same web page. And if you read the web page, you'll find all of these statements, or at the time it was up, you would have. It's no longer up.
Well, if we were to decide, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
If we were to decide that this statement, the man in black statement, is not defamatory per se, where does that leave us? Do we have to reverse this?
No, I don't think so, because you've got 14 statements that are defamatory per se, plus the statement I think is defamatory. You could find that the statement is defamatory per quad, and there was proof of special damages in this case. There was substantial proof of damages north of $1 million. The jury came back with less than that. But there is proof of special damages.
Is there anything in the record, though, that we can look to that says that the jury did not rely upon this particular statement in reaching its verdict as opposed to the other 14?
General jury verdict. So the answer is no.
So, no.
General jury verdict, so the answer is no.
Mm.
Yes.
But you're saying that regardless of whether this was defamatory per se, we could still uphold the verdict because we could read it as defamatory per quad and there are special damages?
Yes, of course. There is proof in the record. If you look at the record, you can see it in context and see that this is defamatory per quad.
Isn't that a jury determination, though? I mean, as opposed to a trial court or any court making that decision? What I would be uncomfortable with there is, are we authorized to do that as an appellate court?
I think that you can look at the record as a whole, and if the jury verdict can be upheld on the basis of the evidence before the jury, yes. I think that Judge Ashby asked me a different question. She asked me a question, can we say that the jury found that statement to be defamatory per se? And the answer is no, I can't say that because it's a general jury verdict. It wasn't special interrogatories for the jury. That's my point. But I do think that the court can take a look at these statements and look at them in the context of the publication and say, yes, in the context of this publication, of course they're libelous. Of course they're libelous per quad, even if we don't find it libelous per se, and there is evidence, substantial evidence, of special damages. And by the way, these are arguments that I just want to take 2 seconds to get to my cross appeal. One of the things that we argued in the court below is that we should be permitted to pursue a claim for extreme and outrageous conduct. And that was dismissed at the close of our case by the trial judge, as was the civil extortion claim. With respect to the extreme and outrageous conduct, Judge Stern determined that He didn't view this conduct, that is, the extortion evidence before the court, as giving, rising to the level of extreme and outrageous conduct. And I sort of had a fun exchange with him about how is it that you can find something as a felony, such as extortion, and not find it in the criminal realm, and not have it be a civilly remedial conduct in the civil realm. And we sort of had a little back and forth on that, but ultimately he determined to dismiss. I think that's erroneous as a matter of law.
But he also didn't determine it was extortion, just the opposite. He decided there was no claim for it. Even if there was a claim for civil extortion, this didn't meet the test of extortion.
Well, what he said was he didn't view the demands by Ms. Goss to be paid in exchange for not publishing these kinds of statements to be extortion.
Right.
So the point here is that's a jury question.
What was the evidence of the extortionate conduct? That Exhibit 14, that's the agreement that they had?
There was actually lots of more than that. There was, and the evidence was that Ms. Goss had three or four times come to Mr. Zuger and his associates and said, unless you pay me a bunch of money, I am going to go to the national press and ruin your business. Unless you pay me a lot of money, I am going to bring a massive lawsuit against you. Unless you pay me lots of money, I'm going to publish that you are publishing counterfeit fine artworks. Mm-hmm. So there was three or four episodes before the exhibit that was talked about, and those are discussed in our opening brief.
But in dismissing the claim, I think what Judge Stern said was he thought Exhibit 14 was the evidence that related to extortion, and that doesn't amount to extortion.
I think,
and that's the ruling it seems like we're left with.
I think, again, and I don't have it right in front of me, so I'm hoping you're not going to stick me with this, but I believe what he said was he believed that the principal evidence was that, and that's in his ruling. But I think that there was evidence before him, not only Exhibit 14, but other evidence that I described in the opening brief. And finally, I'd like to make a point about the civil extortion claim. Judge Stern determined that he would not permit the civil extortion claim to go forward to the trial, to the jury, because he doesn't believe that there is a civil extortion claim in Colorado. Candidly, I can't find any case which establishes a civil extortion claim in Colorado, although there is substantial authority outside of Colorado, and I don't think the appellate courts have ever addressed that question. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you.
We respectfully request that you affirm.
Mr. Case, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you. The jury instruction was instruction number 8 that simply said the complained of statements have been found by the court to be, as a matter of law, defamatory. These statements stand separate and apart from any copyright infringement issues that will be decided in the federal court. There is a copyright suit in federal court still pending today. Jury instruction 9 then listed the 15 statements that were put together by counsel for Mr. Zuber. I concentrated on the man in black statement because I think the inclusion of opinion statements or non-defamatory statements within that list renders the verdict invalid. But I do believe that if you look at the other statements, there are other statements that are also not defamatory. For example, number 8 is, as with any important artist, you must not count on the gallery to authenticate your artwork. Watch out, ADL, the public is getting educated. I would submit that is not, on its own, defamatory. And the point about that you referenced about Salieri and Mozart, I believe that is a fairly arcane reference, not just to average jurors, but to educated people in general. And in fact, I believe that is why Mr. Zuber had to offer the explanation in his trial testimony on June 25th, page 183. He spent a page or two of the trial transcript explaining what that reference was and why he thought it was defamatory.
Does each of the 14 statements have to be defamatory in and of itself? Or can we look at all 14 as if they're one paragraph on a page and say the gist of this is defamatory?
No.
Seems to be what he's suggesting.
It is what he's arguing. And I think, no, that Clark via Giacomini is the case closest that I could find. That if you have statements of opinion or non-defamatory statements mixed in, you can't then just take a general jury verdict, because you don't know what they relied on. And in fact, I would point out that that was the, one of the jurors' initial questions. Jury question number two was, has the issue of whether the statements allegedly made by Ms. Goss were defamatory been already answered in the affirmative by the court? To which the court responded, yes. So I would submit that that was a question that arose in the juror's mind. Are we finding that all these are defamatory?
Mr. Case, do you have any response to Mr. Merrick's argument that there's support in the record for finding that this statement, the Man in Black statement, was defamatory per quote, and that there's proof in the record of special damages, and therefore it doesn't, ultimately I think what he was saying was it doesn't make any difference whether it was...
I have not heard that argument before, that there, that it is liable per quote and that there's proof of special damages. The damages were proven through a simple methodology of taking sales for the previous 5 years and projecting them in the future. And as I pointed out in the brief, those sales are very volatile. For example, the alleged libel took place in the summer of 2010 at Mr. Zuber's Aspen Gallery. Sales of this artwork in 2008 were $200,000. In 2009, they were $23,000, a year before any alleged defamation. So you had a highly volatile.
Was the jury instructed to find special damages?
No. All right, thank you. We'll ask you to.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.